This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Well, hello, everybody. It's Doug Levy coming at you with episode number 8 of Under the Radar, Olympic Athletes You Gotta Meet, my podcast based on my book, Hero Redefined, Profiles of Olympic Athletes Under the Radar. Give that a read if you get a chance. Today, as I applaud our friends at Sports History Network for hosting this podcast, I'm going to confess to cheating just a little bit, because the guy I'm about to introduce you to may be a low-key name now, but in the late 1970s and 1980s, when he was setting 4 world records, when he was winning 2 of the last Olympic medals the USA would see in men's discus, when he was nicknamed Multiple Mac for his world-class throwing ability in 4 different events, and when he was a 6'4", 260-pound chiseled athlete, unafraid to speak his mind, he was anything but under the radar. I can't help but think that if we teleported this guy to present day with 24-hour news cycles and social media, he would be absolute must-see. Well, this morning, he's must-listen. So let's bring in 3-time Olympian and gold and silver medalist in the discus, the great Mac Wilkins. Mac, welcome to the show.
Doug, thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm especially thankful that we're talking here in 2026, because I'm hearkening back to half a century ago, and you had what has to be one of the greatest days ever for a U.S. thrower in the discus at the Mount Sac Relays. If my research is correct, you set not one, but 3 world records that day on 3 successive throws, and you took the discus world record out another 6 feet, and the discus you were using was even a little heavier than regulation. So can you just take a walk back and rewind with us and tell us about that day? As I remember it, you weren't even feeling that great that day.
Sure. Well, there were actually 2 days where world records happened. The first day was at Mount Sac, I believe April 24th, 25th, 24th, something like that. And I was not feeling very well that day. I woke up and it took me about 20 minutes to roll from being in bed to standing on my feet. It was a long and painful process. Fortunately, I was spending the night at my chiropractor's house, Dr. Leroy Perry, and he treated me that morning. He treated me when we got to the stadium, and then after warm-up, he treated me again. And not only did he fix the issue with my back, but my whole body became functioning at a higher level because of the treatment and the alignment. And yeah, that was a big surprise to throw a world record at Mount Sac. The day you're speaking of was actually 7 days later at San Jose State University. And that was a day that I ranked that up there at the top, one of my highest. However, so a week later was the day you're referring to, and that was a big day at another competition at San Jose State University. And that day ranks up there as, in my mind, one of my best performances all time, one of my tops. And I say that because there were a lot of things going on there. I broke John Powell's world record, and John and I were rivals of sorts, and not friendly rivals either at the time. And he was not at Mount Sac when I broke his record. He was, however, competing at San Jose State University the next week, and that was his alma mater. And of course, he held the field record there as well. And so that was a little bit of a frosting on the cake in terms of things to look forward to. In addition to that, every time you do something well, there's a question in your mind, can I repeat this? Can I do this again? So going into that second week at San Jose State, I had that in the back of my mind. Can I repeat this? And so the thing that stands out that makes it really special to me, though, is that I had the clarity of mind to say, here's what I want to do on my first throw. I want to feel this, I want to do this, and so on. And in a competition situation, it's not a long list of details that you go through, but typically it's one, maybe two things, and it's oftentimes it's a feeling that you want to have. So I said the first throw, okay, I'm just going to be nice and relaxed and loose and so on and so forth. And I was, and that was surprising that I could execute my plan. And it was a life record. So normally what happens after you make a life record in a throwing event, especially, is that you'll say, well, that felt easy. I didn't even try on that one. And so I'm going to really try on this one. And you really try and you throw a really poor throw. The result is horrible. It's exactly like a golf swing.
Yeah,
When you don't
easier is
try, you
better.
get the long drive. And when you really try and smash it, you top it and it goes off to the left in the weeds and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so the second throw, I said, okay, now you can go after it a little bit. You don't want to go after it so much that you completely destroy the rhythm and make a horrible throw, but you can do it a little bit. So I went after it a little bit and I even threw another life record. And what's so crazy about it, at least in my mind, is that I don't know how many times, I don't think I've ever had two life records in one competition. That just is unheard of. Usually it happens once and you're completely, you can throw well, but once is an outlier, a fluke, complete magical accident.
Yeah.
But to do it two times and to do it consciously, here's my plan. I execute the plan and it produces the result I expect or that I was hoping for. And then I did that twice in a row. And I thought, holy cow, that's pretty amazing. Okay, the third throw, I don't think I was on balance as well as I could have been. Let's just try and be a little more patient at the start and see if we can feel like we're on balance a little better. And so I tried that. And as soon as I started my turn with my right foot in the air off the ground at the back of the circle and started to say, okay, now it's time to go, I felt like I was in wet cement up to my mid thighs and hard to move. And I felt that way all the way through the throw. And oftentimes when you feel something happening in slow motion, it's perfect. And it might have been, I don't know that it was perfect, but it was better than the previous throw. And I extended my life record a third time, a third consecutive time. And that is completely mind-blowing for me to think that I can plan three throws, execute three throws, and each one be the correct plan and the correct execution, and the result is an improvement. And to throw three life records in one competition is unheard of. To plan them and throw them three consecutive times is, to me, that was just a mind-blowing performance. And it didn't even really think about, well, last week you broke the world record, Turkey. So, you just broke the world's record three times in a row. That was, yeah. Okay. So what? Who cares? It's a life record. Always the life record was the goal. Even when I was 20 feet away from the world record, I was trying to improve, trying to get a better life record. So, yeah, that's the San Jose story.
It's a great one. What a segue, too. This is a great segue because, Matt, you're known as someone who is a real technician. You train like a maniac. You made this incredible commitment to your sport. Medal winning isn't everything in the Olympics. There's so much more to it than that. But as we look at the medal records for the United States, we go back to when you and John Powell won medals, and it's been a dry spell since for the US men. And then, you flip that on its head, the women had a long dry spell, and now we look ahead to LA in 2028. We've got Valerie Almond-Sion and Lalaga Tsagaq Collins, and they could even be one and two for the women. But what's your assessment of just throwing and the discus in the United States? You were among the last medalists, you and John Powell. We haven't gotten there since. Do you have any sort of perspective on that you can give us?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I have a real clear answer. I know that Anthony Washington was world champion with a huge win, I believe, in 1991, in Canada, and he beat the two East Germans, and that was a very big deal. But that was the last world championship Olympic type medal since '84. John and I medaled in '84 and we medaled in '76. And so, what's the story here? The discus has been dominated by the Northern Europeans and Central Europeans, and as well, Jamaica has produced a ton of throwers in all the events, basically. So, why have the American throwers kind of been happy to just make the finals or the top eight in the Olympics? It's a good question, and I'm not sure I know the best answer. I know that I'd say maybe they're just, I don't know if there's enough depth, enough athletes going at it in the discus, in the men's discus in the US. We have some good athletes. We have some good throwers, and then it comes down to, well, what's your life situation like? Is this a scenario where you can commit everything to throwing the discus? I don't know enough to say, well, this guy's not making it because of that, and this guy's not making it because of that, and the Germans have five guys over 68, 69 meters maybe, and you've got to throw 69 meters to get a medal these days, and maybe even 70 meters doesn't win. And that's definitely a step up from my day, but it's an evolution. I just am not sure how to describe why we are so good in the shot and why we are so mediocre in the discus for the men.
We're certainly right there with the top medals in the shot. Well, I think it leads me to another question, because I love that you had a career where you didn't shy away from being candid about the situation for US athletes in your sport. And I wonder, are we taking good enough care of our men's throwers? Are we giving them enough resources here in the United States? You had an interview in Montreal after you won a gold medal where you said pretty bluntly, we're not doing enough to help our throwers. And I wonder, how are we doing now? You've been around the sport for most of your life. You've coached, you train. What's your sense of it all?
Yeah, my sense is that in Montreal, they gave me an airplane ticket to Montreal. They gave me a room and a pass to get into the village to eat and a uniform, and that was the support. Things changed quite a bit after Montreal, and they have continued to evolve and change. And the world of sport has changed, actually. I mean, at one point, the communist bloc was driving the competition, and now it's Yeah, money is a big factor. It's driven the sport in the United States. Olympic sports in the United States are primarily supported and developed by the NCAA programs and the Division I schools. And recently they've changed their scenario, their funding operation, so that ESPN and Fox determine what has value. And basically, that's football and basketball, and the other sports, good luck. But I'm not sure what the impact of that will be in the next 3 to 10 years. My guess is it may not be a positive impact on Olympic sports. And how does that move down to the throwing events? Even World Athletics has a bias against the throwing events in terms of championship appearances and the opportunity to compete where you can earn money. Throwers don't have that opportunity, the same opportunity as runners do. And so, some of it's cultural, some of it's worldwide, and there's always going to be somebody who really loves to throw the discus or the shot put, and they don't want to play football. It's an interesting contrast. The women across the board have benefited from Title IX that became law roughly in the 70s, and the impact started to be felt in the 90s. And there was also, I think, a big increase in knowledge in the United States anyway, in the 90s. And that takes time to filter out and down, and there are more athletes who know more about it. There's a bit of a dilution in my mind going on because of the internet. You can find great information, but you can also find all kinds of information.
It's not all good, but
Not all good. Everybody's an expert. And so the problem remains. The same problem that I had when I was in just starting out and in high school and in college even is everybody's an expert, and should I believe this guy? Does he really know what he's talking about? Is it true? Is it going to help me? Is it something that I can use? And sorting through all the BS is really a huge, huge issue for a young athlete then and now. That's just a huge, huge factor. And if you're unlucky, or if you're not smart and can't figure out the right path or the best path, you could have your career ended after high school. Or, after college, you're just not good enough, and so put it away. And that's the big difference between success and failure.
I want to go back to something you said because you were, I think, correctly noting that, the throwing events in track and field aren't always the glamour events. I'm going to tell you something that bugs me. I want to get your take on it. We talk about track and field, and when you get to the viewing of these events, the TV broadcasts of these events, I almost feel like they've put a big X through the and field part. I mean, you have a very heavy emphasis on the running events, and then once in a while they'll cut away and say, "Hey, here's this guy in the javelin," or take a look at this six jump in the pole vault. And what I think are events with tremendous athletes and drama seem to get the short shrift for the American viewing public. That's always bugged the heck out of me. What's your sense of that, and why, why when we televise these events, do we not give a little more love to the throwers like yourself?
Couple things going on. I think first of all, the live competition itself has been restructured to fit into a TV window, a TV time limit window. And so they reduce the number of events. And certainly at one point they were said, well, let's just give the throws four attempts instead of six. And let's make it a better TV package so we can make more money. And that's kind of what it's all about. And to some degree, yeah, you've got to make money to survive, but how much do we change the sport to fit into the TV money window, basically? And I think that given, say, a state-funded television, and you have free access to the video of the entire event and all the throws, you could pick throws throughout the event and edit together a nice story and splice those into the quote-unquote live coverage of the 10,000 meters. Take a break on the backstretch or something, and here's the fourth round and the second attempt and so on and so forth, and they've improved, and now that moves them into this place, and the competition continues in the women's shot put or something like that. It could be done, but what's the time, effort, and appeal, and return on revenue? And the people running World Athletics are former distance runners, middle and distant runners, and so they're just looking at the bottom line. What's the money? What does TV want? TV wants football and basketball. TV wants, 100 meters and the mile, and maybe,
Flashy stuff.
we want this is what we're going to decide what the market wants. And so it's kind of a difficult cultural battle to fight, Doug. And you have to be aware of it. You have to know that's what's going on when you get into the sport. You're not going to be offered a giant contract, and people aren't going to be wanting to come see you all the time. You got to be doing it for what you get out of it. What's your satisfaction? What's your joy? Things like that.
So you mentioned distance runners. I want to veer into another topic. I'll tell our listeners I'm a little biased here because Mac went to Beaverton High School in Beaverton, Oregon, and then University of Oregon in Eugene, and I went to both of those places too. And at University of Oregon, Mac, you had a certain teammate named Steve Prefontaine, and my gosh, a brilliant athlete, a brilliant runner whose life was cut short. And yet, even today, here we are in 2026, you mentioned the name Steve Prefontaine. It rings a bell with people in so many ways and in so many places. I'm interested in getting your memories of Pre as someone who was out there as a teammate with him, and also maybe contrast for our listeners a little bit his career and yours. His career was so much potential that we'll never find out if he would have fulfilled it. Your career, I think you can look back and say, my gosh, I achieved a lot of things through the 70s and 80s over a lot of years, number one ranking in the world and all of those things. So can you just maybe reconcile those two things a little bit? I'm curious to
Sure.
get your take on food.
Sure. I think I got a real good perspective of all of that about in 1992. I was asked to make some introductory remarks about Pre at a state high school sports award event. And I was trying to put my thoughts together and think about it, and it occurred to me that, wow, what happened here? I became the same guy Pre was. What's going on? Here's the deal. Pre, as a high school senior, was extremely focused, and he made the U.S. national senior men's national team the summer after he graduated from high school, which is unheard of. So very precocious, and he was world class. As a junior in college, he ran in the Olympics and finished fourth. And he was able to do that because he was so focused. He had his priorities very clear, and that's what he wanted to do. And I thought he was, some people thought he was a little arrogant or kind of a jerk at times and insensitive and maybe, but maybe not. I mean, he just knew exactly what he wanted, and he's 19, 20 years old, and some hot chick asked him if he's available to go to the sorority dance the next Friday night, and he says, "Well, no, I can't. I've got a big workout Saturday morning, so I can't do it." And I'm thinking, "Boy, what a dummy! Why is he doing that?" Well, he's doing that because he was on the Olympic team 2 years later, and he
Yeah,
was on the national team the year before. That's why he had that kind of focus. And so, he did have all this potential, and he did achieve a lot. He was at the American level, he was king of the pile. I mean, he had all kinds of American records at distance races, and hadn't quite taken the step up to international and world-class records yet, but finishing fourth in the Olympics at a young age is
certainly sent a message, right? So he's got the
pretty
gas.
clear that, good, he's moving in the right direction. And
Yeah.
absolutely, all it takes is a little bit of time. And unfortunately, he never had that time.
Yeah.
And so it just became clear to me that I developed that focus. He was more mature than I was as an athlete by, 4 or 5 years. And so I remember making silly statements like, "Well, I really don't like Thanksgiving or Christmas because they close the gym on those days and I can't train." And that's, yeah, okay, I get the point, but if you're really smart, why don't you write your program so you don't have to train on those days? It's, come on, dude, wake up. But anyway, I had that kind of focus, and that's the same focus that Pri had.
Yeah,
And I said,
served you
"Oh,
both well.
so that's what it takes. That's the kind of focus you have to get that kind of success." Because Pri died in 1975. Everybody was expecting that in 76 would be his big breakout year. 76 was my big breakout year. I achieved everything everybody expected him to achieve, a world record, an Olympic medal, and so on and so forth. That's really curious the way that works, or the way that worked out. But yeah, in my mind, it was just a matter of focus and maturity, and it took me a while to get there. And he was there, as a senior in high school.
Yeah. Well, I also think of stolen time, and I want to talk to you about 1980 and that sort of cross section between sport and politics that happened in 1980. And in the book that I wrote, I interviewed another University of Oregon athlete, pole vaulter named Tom Hinton, who was at the top of his craft
Right.
heading into the 1980 games. And then this decision gets made by the United States with the boycott, and it's a psychological blow to the head. You suffered that same blow. You were able to compete and win in 76 and come back and gain a silver in 1984, and then you competed one more time in 1988. But surely I mean, I think there's an excellent chance we'd be talking about a four-time Olympian and three-time medalist hadn't gotten the opportunity to compete in 1980. All these years later, Matt, what's your feeling about not only 1980, but when politics and sport get meshed up together?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know at the time it was really frustrating, and I thought it was a complete sellout. I really liked Jimmy Carter, but I thought it was a very naive decision to be made. I went to Russia twice to compete in 1973, and I came away thinking, these guys are kind of shady the way they operate. I don't I don't really feel comfortable about some of that stuff, but you go back to the big picture and who won the gold medal, who won the silver medal? So what if only half the world was there? These are the results, and this is the way it kind of goes down in the record book, and all kinds of things are omitted, and people get trampled and crushed, and sometimes that's just the way it goes. I mean, what's going on right now with the World Cup? How many people are not engaged in World Cup activities because of the border control in the US? I don't know. But at the end of the day, it all goes down as somebody won, and that's the story. And it's unfortunate. That's kind of the way things play out. I really think it's unfortunate if Olympic sport gets hijacked by politicians or oligarchs, and they turn it into something else. I mean, I know that I have worked with athletes from China and Iran and Russia, and competed with and against athletes from those countries. And although there have been really tense times politically between my government and their government, at an athletic level, it's all about sport.
Yeah, there's a
And
bond.
there is a common bond in sport. We share the same passion. We share the same desires in terms of athletics, and that's what brings us together, and that's more important. That's higher level connection than anything that our governments have to do with each other. Governments
The
are
beauty of the
completely
Olympic movement, right?
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. You wonder why they came upon that years and years ago, 100 plus years ago, for
Yeah.
1896 anyway. And what, back in the Greek times, they would call time out to the wars, and the athletes would compete as athletes, not as from one country versus another. So yeah, it's real. It's sad. It's unfortunate. I know that in Moscow in 1980, that was my second Olympic team of the four. The Soviets won all four of the men's throwing events. And yeah, they probably should have won the hammer with Yuri Sadik. And they may have had a reasonable chance in the javelin, but certainly not in the shot or the discus. But they had help from the officials, and it would have been a real tough environment to,
Yeah,
no matter
yeah.
what. I mean, Delisle from Cuba had a throw, I think, that was probably a meter farther than the Russians' best throw, but it was marked back so that Delisle got a silver medal and the Russian won. So, and that, how do you beat that? How do you? Ian Campbell, an Australian triple jumper, was disqualified for dragging his foot. He was the favorite, but he didn't get a legal mark. So the Russian won.
So
It's anyway.
I'll lighten it up a bit because let's fast forward to 1984 and folks, you competed in Los Angeles. And now looking ahead for 2028, we've got Los Angeles getting ready to host its third Summer Games. And it's going to be quite a spectacle. And you were there, of course, the last time we brought a United States to the Los Angeles. What advice would you give these Team USA athletes who are going to be going there that may not know much about Southern California? Any sort of tips of the trade that you would pass along, or things that were aha moments for you?
Well, all I can say is anytime you go to an Olympic Games, It's a whole new landscape to navigate, and you've got to do your research and get as much information as you can to know how best to navigate and then plot your course, where you're going to be and what time and how much time it takes to get there on the bus and this and that and the other thing. And so you've got to do all that research, which is what you do anywhere because it's in Los Angeles. If you're an American athlete, it's going to be a little easier, perhaps, because everybody speaks the language and it's kind of like you're in home, you're home, you are home. It's not kind of like it is, it's your home. So it should be easier to do all that navigation, but you still need to do all the research, all the preparation, all the planning, all the scheduling, and still expect the unexpected. Stuff might happen. So you're going to have to plan a little extra margin in your time schedule to make sure you can do what you need to do. I know in 84, people were talking about horrible smog and horrible traffic jams, and everything would get shut down. And because it was the Olympics, I think a lot of locals stayed away. The freeways were pretty much wide open, and the air was pretty much clear. So it wasn't an issue. I don't know what's going to happen in 2028, to be determined. I kind of think they'll be able to manage it. But even back in 1976, there were, oh, there's terrorists and they're going to have a bomb, and you got to don't go here at this time because this is going to happen. I heard that in 76. I heard that in Los Angeles in 84. I heard it in Seoul in 88. And fortunately, none of that ever happened, but there's always those rumors and fears to deal with as well. But that kind of comes with, yeah, it comes with the territory.
I ask you, Matt, you had a pretty long career, and I think you must look back and think, hey, I put my all into it, and you did some great work. You had all these world rankings. Now you do some coaching and training, I believe, but what is it like to be so enmeshed in the sport and so dedicated to the sport? And then, you spend so many years of your life stepping away from that sport. What's it like to make that transition? I'm just curious as to, how the post-competition years have been for you. You ever kind of have that blown up, man? Folks got to be able to step back into that circle kind of thing. So what's like to be the separation?
I think I can follow the thread there. You talk about dedication, and it's just, to me, it's dedication, but it's also, I really enjoy it. I just love it, and I can't get enough of it. And the way to get better is to focus a little more on it and to look at it from a different perspective and to experiment with this and try that. And so, it doesn't feel like it's work. It feels like this is what I want to do. To not be able to do it is a sacrifice. And that's the way I looked at my training. There was a time where I said, yeah, I think I want to be able to look at myself as I've achieved as much, or I've shared as much, I've given as much as a coach as I have as an athlete. And so, that's kind of the goal, is looking at myself as a world record holder, former world record holder. So I'm like a wave that comes up on the beach, and four times I made a higher watermark than anybody else ever has. And so now I want to be a big swell out in the ocean and pushing others up to go beyond my mark and to get more out of themselves than I was able to get out of myself. And that's what turns me on. That's what's exciting. The whole thing about this is that it had has been it is my a passion of mine, and it's love. I love this stuff, and there's only value to love when you share it with others. And so I feel really compelled now to try and share as much as I can. I'm not working daily face to face with any athlete at this point in time, but I do online work, and I see athletes from time to time live and, at the circle. But I'm trying to, use all the modern tools to categorize my knowledge and to find easier, better ways for people to access it, for me to share it. And so that's kind of the direction I have right now. That's what I'm involved with.
Great.
More sharing, whether it's a public speaking or an appearance or talking to you on a Zoom call.
Yeah.
It's all good stuff.
Well, you're so used to, I think, getting questions about yesteryear. I want to ask you about just going forward. Not a lot of people know you've had a several decade long marriage to your wife, Fran, and here you are at 75 years young. What's the next 5 years look like for the Wilkins family? What do you think we're going to be talking about 5 years from now that you've done
Boy,
and accomplished?
that's a hard one to answer. We moved recently so we could be near our first grandchild, and that's a real joy watching him grow. He's now almost 9 months, and every couple of days there's new skills, new awareness that we see, and so that's terrific fun. I'm still working with athletes and trying to help folks and enjoying doing that, enjoy sharing. That's what it's all about. So it's, family and sharing, and it's a question of, where do we want to go? What do we want to do? How do we want to share with our family, be with our family? And I want to share with athletes, and we don't feel like we're tied down to living here in the US, but certainly the grandson is a good reason to be here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's end on a prediction note. You have any sort of predictions about what we're going to see in the coming Olympics, whether it's discus or javelin or shot put? You have any sort of
Boy,
under the radar U.S. athletes you want to highlight here?
that's a good question. I think it will be I will be interested in watching to see if Ryan Crouser can get his fourth gold medal.
Yeah. And you coached him a bit. Yeah.
I think I first saw him throw when he was 10. I know his dad real well, Mitch, and so we lived in the Portland area, and so I got to see him. And yeah, and was kind of his coach in 2016 before the Rio Olympics, a coach in title, but kind of I did. Anyway, I
See if
want
he
to
can get
see
a
them.
fourth.
Pardon me?
Want to see if he can get a fourth gold medal.
Oh, absolutely. And that would unprecedented, unprecedented. And this is a much, much different time than the 60s, 50s, 60s, when Al Order won four gold medals in the discus. This is a much different time. I think there was a time when he would hardly throw for a year. He'd go back to work and, had a 4 hour a week work day, work week. Ryan's a full-time shot putter. But anyway, the women's shot will be very interesting in my mind to see what happens to 21 meters. How many throws go over 21? I'm also interested to see the women's discus
Yeah.
to see if Valerie can hang on as well as Ryan can hang on, because they are past the beginning of their career, let's put it that
Yeah.
way.
Yeah.
And that's always the question is, you never know how f long you're going to throw the discus in terms of days or in terms of meters. You just don't know how long it will last. So,
Yeah.
but that would be a good one to see. And certainly she's quite capable as a defending champion of winning again. How does the age factor happen? How does that impact her result? Javelin throw is interesting for everybody but Americans. And sorry, we're still completely screwed up on that one in this country. And I think our hammer throwers can move up another step. They've been really good lately, really good. Again, the result of Title IX and also just additional knowledge. I know back in the 80s, the momentum grew. Anyway, hammer throw, javelin throw, Americans in the shot put, Americans in the women's discus. Yeah, I don't know. It could be really exciting for the US.
Well, that's gonna end it. We're gonna put a wrap on this. But Mac Wilkins, I want to thank you for carving some time out of your day to talk with us here on Under the Radar. It's been my pleasure to speak with you. And for our listeners, tune in again next month. We'll have another athlete we'll talk to and visit with. And thanks all of you for listening.
Thanks, Doug. My pleasure.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.